What's happened?
Why did Jesus wish to celebrate the Passover? Or why did he? Maybe he didn't wish to. Why did he celebrate that?
When, I mean, starting at Bethany? Because I don't think he operated in defiance of accepted social usage.
But that time, he used to do it. I guess there were some.
Did he, as a human being?
There were some.
I don't think so. Don't forget that the entire Jesus movement was drawn from the Commonwealth of Israel. All these followers were Jewish except a few Greeks on the fringe. The entire start that Christianity got was drawn 100% almost out of the Jewish ranks.
Well?
The 12 apostles were Jews.
Sure.
The 70 were Jews. Abner was a Jew. Nicodemus.
He told them that if he had just broken completely with the Jewish tradition, maybe it would have kind of...
But he loved those traditions. These were the things that he grew up with, that he knew as a little boy.
As a son of man.
Yes, of course, as a human being. Here, when you hear him sung, they're thrilling to you, aren't they? They're not to me because I never heard them sung. They're outside of my experience. And you love these things because they're what you heard when you were a child. You went to church. It's old and it's familiar. And don't forget that Jesus, as a human being, was just as much a part of his culture as we are a part of our culture. The Passover to Jesus was a perfectly natural thing to celebrate. Now, he celebrated it without the lamb because his theology argued against the sacrificial aspect of the Passover. But he would celebrate the Passover for the same reason that I enjoy celebrating Thanksgiving or Christmas or any of the other holidays, the 4th of July as an American. And to me, Thanksgiving would be a very poor Thanksgiving with roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. And yet in Canada, they celebrate the old English celebration of the Harvest Inn gathering, and it's celebrated with roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. The turkey is an American form of celebration. Well, I mean, I'm just used to turkey on Thanksgiving. It seems right. I think Jesus conformed to the social custom. Not as a concession, because it was the normal, natural thing to do, and as a human being, I think he enjoyed it.
He was instructed to.
Yes, but I don't think there was any problem there. This is what he grew up with, and he was just as much a part of his day and age as we are a part of our day and age. Example, I don't think Michael could have wept over the city of Jerusalem, but Jesus, a Jew, certainly could weep over Jerusalem, knowing that his father's people had reached third base, and very few people ever got to third base, and they were going to die on third. This is a real tragedy.
You know, I might have said that the other time. That is something else.
This was a Jew weeping.
You see, I still had an animal instinct of being a little rescue.
To what?
Well, that is in me.
He knew the history of the struggle.
He's inside is something that kind of...
Sure. But he knew that this was only a part of the group, and he understood why. It's because the Jewish people lost the great ideological battle that was fought out during the Babylonian captivity between the priests and the prophets. And now stop and think how difficult it was for the prophets. Think of the job Deutero-Isaiah had to convince the people who were in captivity that theirs is not a political mission on earth, that they're not to be a nation, that they are to be something more. Now, what American would buy that bill of goods? Now, please, 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 now, we're in Brazil. We're in captivity. And there are two groups, see? There are pastors, and there are some irregular people who didn't go to theological seminary. And the irregular people tell us that it's not too important whether we speak English or Spanish, and that we shouldn't rail against these conquering Brazilians who've got us working on their plantations down there. And we said, well, who are you? Said he. Now, our pastors who occupy our pulpits, they say, remember George Washington, remember Thomas Jefferson, and they appeal to our patriotism. They say, we shall go back and we'll rebuild Washington, and we will restore the Stars and Stripes to all its pristine freshness and glory, and we will be a people, free, each man sitting under his own vine, and no one shall trouble him. You translate this in terms of American patriotism, and then you can see what the priests were doing. And so they take all our traditions and they rewrite them to glorify the United States of America and to make us want to go back to America, to take boats from Brazil and come back and rebuild Washington. This is a parallel. This is a struggle between nationalism and internationalism. And the priests had nationalism on their side, and Isaiah had internationalism. Isaiah failed. And this meant that the whole concept of the Messiah was to come as a restorer of the American glories of Washington.
Was that Daniel
Wheat? It was Mary Wheat. No, it's Simon Zelotes. Simon Zelotes.
Inability to disassociate himself from nationalism. And
Simon Zelotes. Simon the Zealot.
Well, there was one other one against tradition. That's immature. But Bill, will you embellish two things? Maybe this is all for me. If it is, maybe they'll bear witness.
You've got to drop it all for me, so I'll know this.
Will you embellish and give me, because I am too big and I am able to find, to my satisfaction, the political and military situation that arose that caused the imprisonment of the Jewish race in Egypt, and briefly take us through that the time into the Exodus. Would you do that and entire time split for me?
To the best of my memory, I will.
Entire time.
This will be simple because I've forgotten the details, but I remember the broad picture.
It's quite simple, but I don't know.
The Jewish people came out of Egypt, a ragtag bunch of ignorant Bedouins.
Forgive me, Bill.
Yes.
Will you put a map for me?
All right. There were, from time to time, when drought would make the arid regions uninhabitable, there would be movements of the nomadic peoples from the less watered areas into the more fertile areas. This is a matter of climate cycle. Most of the great invasions that came out of Asia, Huns, Avars, Magyars, and so forth, Scythians, Sarmatians, they all got started because the rainfall gave out. And so people moved into better areas. We have these cycles right here in the Midwest. You had a drought cycle that ended, what, 5-6 years ago.
They immigrated to the Nile Valley.
Yes, now.
Of their own volition, they were there.
They were driven there by climatic change,
right.
Probably. Now, they did not come as conquerors because the Egyptians were too strong. The Egyptians took them in as contract laborers. In other times, in other places.
Actually, went to California.
Yes. In an earlier age, other nomads called the Hyksos came into Egypt, and they conquered, and they ran the country for a while. These Semites, Arabs, if you please, that's one of the funny things about the fight between Jew and Arab today. The pure-blood Jew is a Semite. Although many so-called Jews have no Jewish blood whatsoever. None. They're Khazars. We'll get into the Khazars in a minute. You want a story of the Jewish people?
Right.
I'll give it to you. And you won't be too proud of being a Gentile when I'm through. These people wanted out. The Egyptians took brutal advantage of them. They occupied about the same status as Negro labor in the South, except they were not a servile people. They were a people that had their own traditions of liberty, freedom, and fighting. they develop some cohesiveness, probably due to being organized for work on canals, public buildings, and the like. They were working on public buildings, probably in Egypt. They had a nucleus of leaders who had an Egyptian education. Moses probably was half Egyptian, half Jewish. Jethro and a few others also were educated men. They had as a background the traditions of the days of Melchizedek. Although the Jewish people were not strong believers in El Elyon. In fact, they didn't believe in much of anything. They were full of superstition, full of fears. Their religion was a very primitive sort of thing. I'm talking about the mine-run, illiterate, common laborer.
That was at the time of bondage.
That's at the time of bondage. About 1200 B.C., Moses made a break for liberty. Put down 1200. That's not a bad date. And forgive me on some of these dates because I'm calling them from memory.
Mr. Ruff.
He made a break.
Moses started leaving and started
taking. That's right. He waited until Pharaoh, the Egyptian army, was down around the third cataract in the south, fighting off the Ethiopians, the Numidians, and until the sea peoples, probably the same group that smashed Knossos in Crete, until the Dorians, the early Greeks, were attacking the Delta. The Delta is the mouth of the Nile. And when the Egyptians were working at both ends, Moses made a break for liberty, pursued by the household troops. Right. And I think the tradition of the Red Sea parting is pure myth. I think they just waited until they could outnumber the Egyptian armed forces, and they probably fought them off. Pretty well slaughtered the household troops. They made a break. They wandered around on the Sinai Peninsula. Moses, I think, was influenced by the teachings of Amenemope, who was an Egyptian leader, teacher, by the teachings of Akhenaten. If you want to get a background of the moral climate of Egypt, get a book called The Dawn of Conscience by Preston. This is an analysis of moral teachings along the Nile. And as the blue book, Preston, The Dawn of Conscience, B-R-E-S-T, maybe E-A-D. It's a very famous Egyptologist. It's in that book you will find the best account of the teachings of Amenemope, and also Preston will there give you the Egyptian sources of the Old Testament writings. He will point out to you that certain passages in the Old Testament which contain peculiar idiom that make no sense among a pastoral people make exquisite sense among a river-dwelling people. Mm-hmm. And he'll cite you the parallel passages showing how deeply the Jewish people were in debt for their head start to the Egyptian education which a few, a corporal's guard of leaders had. Moses, Jethro, Joshua, and a few others. Moses, I think, had a very advanced concept. And this Jew comes very close to being an ideal of mine. Moses succeeded. Akhenaten failed. Akhenaten, as Pharaoh of Egypt, with the Egyptian Army, Navy, and Marine Corps behind him, couldn't push monotheism across because he was a rigid, brittle idealist, just like Abner in the days of Jesus. He failed totally. Moses was a politician. Moses was willing to roll with the punches. Moses didn't hesitate. When he couldn't put monotheism across, he dug a second line of trenches and retreated. He sold henotheism. He said, all right, there's more than one God, but there's no one bigger than Yahweh. Yahweh is the head God. Because he knew from that second line they could someday advance again to monotheism. Moses got a break when Sinai blew its stack, and I don't know how much conniving went on in this shrewd old leader's mind, and how long he was up on that mountain, and how much play-acting there was. because here's a man who has got a desperately difficult problem. He has got a rabble, a literal rabble of illiterate Bedouins, nomads. How's he going to weld them into a people and give them a religion? He succeeded, and I think he succeeded first because he was a shrewd politician as well as having a clear-cut ideal. And he succeeded because, I think, the volcano blew up. And this was very convincing. These people never conquered Canaan. They infiltrated Canaan. They came in as a less cultured group, working with a more cultured group. Much of the Old Testament reflects not only a struggle between polytheism and monotheism, but also a struggle between the land customs of the Bedouins and the land customs of agriculturalists. So you've got a peculiar switch here. The polytheists had a more advanced civilization than the monotheists. The polytheists believed in the private ownership of land. The monotheists believed in the tribal ownership of land, as you have it in a pastoral society. Eventually, the Jewish people intermarried, interlocked with the Canaanites, adopted many of their customs in turn, became one of the peoples of Palestine. They had as refugees over on the coastline Philistines. And these people were probably the most culturally advanced group in Palestine because they had iron at a very early age. I suspect that the Philistines were refugees from Crete. The island of Crete was smashed by the invading Greek barbarians at about the time Moses left Egypt. These same seafarers were probably the ones that were harassing the Nile Delta. I think you have no real tradition of monotheism. I think you have no real acceptance of monotheism during these times. The Old Testament as we have it today is a rewrite in the days of the captivity to make this into the darndest piece of propaganda that's ever been written since the Russians rewrote history to prove communism. This is a complete rewrite of history designed to glorify the Jewish people and to build up the monotheistic concept. As the Blue Book says, there never were 12 tribes to begin with. There were just a couple of good-sized tribes. Benjamin, Ephraim, Judah, and a few other little ones. These people established a precarious kingdom, which became two. And they lived on the fringe of Palestine itself is an Alsace-Lorraine between two major centers of civilization, Mesopotamia in the east and Egypt in the southwest. As the Mesopotamians were in the ascendancy, Palestine and Phoenicia became under their rule. When the Egyptians were in the ascendancy, Palestine and Phoenicia were under Egyptian rule. When it was a standoff, then Palestine and Egypt could be independent.
And could flourish
on their own. The whole thing, Toynbee points out that the Damascus area, Palestine, and Phoenicia are basically an independent culture, a Semitic culture, regardless of the fact they were never unified politically, and that they made three major contributions to human civilization. They discovered monotheism, the alphabet, and the Atlantic Ocean. He lumps the Phoenicians right in with the Jewish people as being an identical race. They're all a Semitic group.
Well, the Alsace-Lorraine analogy is quite complicated.
That's
very
right.
Now,
Alsace-Lorraine at times achieved independence. You've heard of Burgundy. Mm-hmm. In The Vagabond King, the Burgundians are threatening Paris. And one of the highlights in one of the songs is, "And to hell with Burgundy." Burgundy at one time was an independent state, or at least an independent duchy, and held its own against France on the one hand and Germany on the other. The ragtag end of Burgundy today is Holland and Belgium in the north. The rest of it is either French or German. This situation obtained until the Palestinians maintained a precarious independence, all the more so after they split into two kingdoms. As you will recall in the Blue Book, David is made out to be quite a low-down political type. When they rewrote the Old Testament, they really rewrote David's character.
They tell a lot of things in the Old Testament.
Well, David's treatment of Uriah is one of the dirtiest tricks that a monarch ever played on a well-meaning colonel of infantry. First he gets his wife pregnant, then he sends for the old boy so that he can explain the pregnancy, and when the old boy won't sleep with his wife while there's war on, he has him put in the front rank so he'll be sure to be killed. The morals of those days, again, are the proper yardstick for the judgment of conduct at those times. We have no right to judge those people by our standards any more than we will care to be judged by the standards of 1,000 years from now. I think one of my favorite texts from the Old Testament is the story of David's old age. As it says, when the king waxed old and his body gat no heat, they did put a virgin to bed with him. And when nothing happened, then they knew the end was near. When his body gat no heat, that appeals to me very much. David was a very salty character. Solomon was a shrewd operator. And these people profited by the fact that neither Egypt nor Mesopotamia were strong at that time. They suffered terribly when the Assyrians were on the rampage. And Assyria became a serious menace along about 800 B.C., 700 B.C., and in through there. They formed confederations to check the Assyrians. You see, Assyria...
Bill, straighten me out my geography.
All right, now, Assyria. Can you visualize Mesopotamia?
Oh, yeah, I have that.
All right.
Where is Assyria with the Alsace-Lorraine and...
Assyria is at the north end of Mesopotamia.
All right, I'm waiting.
Really,
okay.
At the northwest end.
In other words,
Mesopotamia runs at a diagonal, you know.
Such aggressive actions would come in from the north end,
right.
Probably along the coastline.
Now, let's make it parallel. Can you think of when the Turks were invading Europe?
Right.
Can you think of the importance that Austria played? Because Austria was the shield of Europe. Assyria was the shield of Mesopotamia against the barbarians. A shield, Assyria was what they call, what you might call a marcher province. Let me explain that. A marcher province is a frontier province where your local civil administrator is also a military commander. The marcher provinces in England faced Wales when Wales was not a part of England. In Germany, the term count is Graf, G-R-A-F. A marching count is called a Margraf, whence we get the term Marquis. And a Marquis outranks a count by 1 degree. Count being the same as an English earl. A marcher earl in England had military as well as civil authority. The term mark means a march. The Mark of Brandenburg was once one of the German marches protecting Germany from the Slavs. The original name for Austria is Ostmark, which means the Eastern March. So Assyria was a frontier marcher province acting as a shield for Mesopotamia. And sometimes these marcher provinces, instead of defending the civilized hinterland, become conquerors. And Assyria became the conqueror of Mesopotamia, Palestine, Phoenicia, and for a short time, Egypt. Assyria was the terror of the ancient world. They put iron to use very effectively. They had the best army that the ancient world probably ever developed. And Assyria lasted until a confederation rose against her of the Babylonians, the Persians, and the Medes. And they sacked Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria. They did not smash the Assyrian army. It retired intact and lasted at, I think, Haran, which is near Nineveh, for about 10 years. It was finally destroyed. This then left things in a status quo ante. Sort of like they set the clock back after the days of Napoleon. You know, Napoleon overran Europe and changed all the boundaries and ended up the Treaty Congress of Vienna. When you compare before and after Napoleon, there's quite a similarity with some shifts. You have an independent Babylonia. You have an independent Persia, an independent Media. You have an independent Egypt. And you have independent states in Phoenicia and Damascus and Palestine. This is the twilight of Jewish independence. And this lasted until the Jewish boys kept playing footsie between the Egyptians and the Babylonians. And they first went under Egyptian bondage, and then later on, Babylonia conquered them lightly. Then when they rebelled, she really crushed them. Now this is in the 600s, thereabout, near 700, right, in the 7th century BC, the 600s. The Babylonians, this is Nebuchadnezzar and all that. The Babylonians pulled down the walls of Jerusalem in their final conquest, and they simply deported the Jewish people to Babylon. And many of them never came back. From this fate, they were rescued by the conquests of Cyrus, Belshazzar's feast, meeny, meeny, fecal, eupharson, etc. Cyrus was the Persian who, in conquering Babylon and Media, established the Persian Empire, and he liberated the Jewish people. It was during this Babylonian captivity in the 600s BC that the big ideological battle was fought between the clergy, patriots, and Deutero-Isaiah, with the concept of a God of all nations and a non-nationalistic approach to religion. And it was the victory of the clergy patriots that determined the rewriting of the Old Testament as we now have it, the elimination of all mention of anything which did not glorify the Jewish people, except for some oversights on their part, and the building up of the Jewish national consciousness to the level of a Haran folk. See, the Jewish ego is very similar to the Nazi ego. And the Jewish are like the Irish. They have not oppressed many people because there are too damn few of them. The Irish have a pretty clean record because there aren't enough Irish to oppress anyone. The Irish should be just as big a bunch of stinkers as the English if there'd been enough Irishmen. You follow me? I'm part Irish, so I have a right to say this. The only people who have never oppressed other people have been few in numbers. It's human nature to oppress, I think. The Jewish people went back and they rebuilt the temple. And under the Persians, they had a pretty easy time. The Jewish people were an autonomous principality within the Persian Empire. Very little known.
600, or is this now 500?
We're now going down from 500 and 400 into about 300 and... About 330 B.C. We're going through a couple hundred years in here now. Very little is known about this period.
From 300 to 100?
No, from roughly from 550 to about 350. Not much is known. The Persians were governed with a loose rein. The Persians believed in local autonomy. Cyrus was a political genius.
Was he a Babylonian or a Persian?
Cyrus was a Persian.
Persian.
You know where Persia proper was a province down around the Persian Gulf and a little ways inland from Elam. Persis is the name of it. Cyrus conquered because he brought peace. And after the Assyrian Holocaust and all the wars, people were fed up with, war. And he governed with a loose rein. In other words, you got local customs, local gods. Fine, we'll adopt them. You can have your local religion. Just pay taxes to the imperial government. He broke his empire up into satrapies. You occasionally hear the word satrap used to designate a big mogul.
Yes.
It's not used as often, but the word satrap was a viceroy in the Persian Empire in charge of one of the main provinces. Those were the primary divisions, like the states of our union. This lasted until Alexander smashed the Persian Empire. Now, just to pick up a couple of familiar happenings, during this time we have Marathon, 490 B.C. We have Salamis and Plataea, 10-20 years later. We have the Peloponnesian War, which smashed Greece in the later 400s. Pericles, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle. We're now down in the early 300s, the early 300s. And you have Aristotle and Philip of Macedon. And he was the guy that built the state and the nucleus of the army that smashed Greece, that enlisted Greece, and his son Alexander smashed Persia. This is about 335, more or less, B.C. Still no problem with the Jewish people. Alexander's empire broke up within the 30 years after his death, and it was parceled out among a group of people called the Diadochi. And that is a Greek word meaning successors. That's all it means. And it's used in a peculiar sense in history as the successors of Alexander. And they were his generals. Ptolemy got Egypt. Cleopatra was a later day descendant of the Ptolemies. Antiochus got the bulk of the Asiatic portion of Alexander's empire. This included Palestine, Syria, I'll use modern terms, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, all the way into the Indus River. It was with the successors of Antiochus, and they alternated between the name Antiochus and Seleucus. Antioch was named for Antiochus. They're called the Seleucidae. That's the name of the house that ruled. It was with these people that the Jews eventually came into collision. Greek culture had an extremely penetrating effect. Most surrounding cultures disclosed a high degree of porosity to Greek culture. They might resist other penetrating cultures, but Greek culture had a siren song to sing. The empire of the Seleucidae was nibbled at in the east. It was finally broken in the middle by the Parthians, who came down from what's now the Caspian region and cut off the eastern chunk of this empire from the western chunk by invading what's now modern Persia. There was a Greek remnant left in the east called Bactria, which is an interesting story that doesn't concern us. The western portion of this empire was reduced to what's now Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Jordan. Roughly the Fertile Crescent.
Still, Egypt is where?
Egypt is independent under the Ptolemies.
Still under the Ptolemies.
Right. Greece is a mishmash with Macedonia to the north. Rome is making its appearance. It was at about this time when the Parthians were tying up the Seleucidae in the east that the Maccabees arose in Palestine. And these were pretty potent generals. And they fought like holy hell. I understand that the Jew of that time was famed as a mercenary soldier. They were known as hard fighters, like the Swiss in the Middle Ages. The Jews fought and got their independence because they had the covert and sometimes overt backing of Rome. Rome made its first appearance in this area about 190-odd B.C., when the Roman legions tackled the last great military leader of the Seleucidae, Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great, and they smashed him at the Battle of Magnesia. That's the first Roman venture in the East. She didn't come to conquer. She came to knock Antiochus down. It was Roman policy to divide and rule. So for 100 years, or 150 years, the Roman Senate was pro-Jewish. Because as long as the Jews are independent, that's one more little kingdom. And the more little kingdoms we have out there, the less trouble we have to fear in the east, in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. We want lots of small states, see, divide and rule. The Jews under the Maccabees prospered. They rebuilt their kingdom. At one time, under Alexander somebody or other, who was a Jew, this kingdom reached its largest extent, even larger than it was in the days of David and Solomon.
Was this after Carthage?
Carthage fell in 146 B.C. Right, and Corinth was destroyed by the Romans in 146 B.C. You can figure that Rome is dominant in the Mediterranean after that date. That's a good date to remember. 146 B.C. You got two for one, both Carthage and Corinth. Corinth was destroyed and Carthage was destroyed by the legion. From 146, for another 100 years, Rome is in a position of exercising dominance in the Mediterranean lands. She has not yet conquered them all, but there's no more question in anybody's mind. This is the number one power. The Jewish state continued. The Parthians completed their conquest of the Empire of the Seleucidae east of Mesopotamia and even in Mesopotamia. In the days of Jesus, we're getting close to this now, there were men living who could remember when the Parthians raided all the way to the Mediterranean seacoast. These Parthians were not a highly civilized group. They were cavalrymen, nomads. They never built a strong state, but their cavalry was very effective, as the Roman legions found out every time they got caught out in the sand. The first triumvirate was Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus. And it was Crassus who led the legions east. He was the rich guy, you know. And the Parthian mounted archers made mincemeat out of the legions and poured molten gold down Crassus' throat. You may remember that from your Latin. Just before the birth of Jesus, or just after the birth of Jesus, I guess, the last Palestine was subdivided into four. The kingdom of Palestine, the kingdom of the Jews, was subdivided into four principalities, and they were called fourth kingdoms, or tetrarchies, meaning a fourth of a kingdom. And their rulers were called tetrarchs instead of kings. They were kinglets, if you please, or grand dukes, to use a modern term. Herod Antipas ruled two parts of the old kingdom. He ruled in Perea and Galilee. Philip was a tetrarch ruling opposite Galilee, across the Jordan. I forget the name of it. Herod Archelaus ruled in Judea. Archelaus got himself into a jam with the Romans, and they pulled him out and replaced him with a Roman governor, which is why Pontius Pilate was in Jerusalem instead of a tetrarch. the old kingdom of Herod the Great was ruled by native princes except for the fourth part represented by Judea, which was under direct Roman rule. And this is where they had all the trouble with images in the temple. This goes back to the days when they fought the Greeks. And this is why you have such bitterness between Greek culture and Jewish culture. This is why Joseph blew his stack when Jesus suggested they go home and build a gymnasium and an amphitheater like they had in Scythopolis. These Greek cities, the ten cities, the decapolis, 10 cities is what that means. Deca from 10, polis from city. The decapolis. These cities were founded by the Greco-Macedonians when this was a province in Alexander's empire. This is why Flavius had pictures in his home, despite the Mosaic injunction, thou shalt make no graven image, etc. And this is where you have a division between those who hate Greek culture and those who like Greek culture. That's the picture pretty well down to the times of Jesus. This condition continued until the revolt of the Jewish people, which was crushed by Titus. Well, who was his old man? Vespasian? Doesn't sound right. Titus finished the job. And this was within the memory of men living in the days of Jesus. This is roughly about 50 A.D., or 60 thereabouts, when they smashed Jerusalem again. Around 150 A.D. was the last revolt of the Jewish people. And this is when the Romans simply emptied Judea of Jewish people. They built a Roman city on the site of Jerusalem. And I don't think there were just any Jews left there at all. You want to hear the rest of the story of the Jewish people? That's not a nice story. The Jewish people have asked for some of their troubles. They've asked for them because they were a different people. One of the facts I've used to help a Jew understand his relationship to a non-Jewish society has been the fact that the first persecutions and the wholesale killing, slaughtering of Jews took place in Alexandria before the times of Jesus. This is not a Christian peculiarity. In Alexandria, you had a three-phase society. There were the Egyptians. They're the underdogs. They lost the last battle, so they understand their position. There are the Greco-Macedonians. They're the top dogs. They won the last battle, so everybody understands this. But then there's the Jewish community, one of the largest communities outside of Palestine in the ancient world. These people don't fit. They're not bottom dog. They're not top dog. They don't conform to local custom. They don't eat pork.
Now, how did they get to Alexandria? They migrated back after the Exodus from there.
That's right. They were there during when this was probably before the revolt of the Maccabees.
What are you talking? 800 BC?
No, I'm talking about 100 BC now.
Hmm?
I'm talking 100 BC, roughly. 100 years before the birth of Jesus.
Well, that's right, but I'm trying to get this clear. When there were
Jews in Egypt,
when the
first person,
middle layer of the Egyptian population was
Alexander.
Jewish.
Alexander conquered Egypt roughly 335 BC.
And Alexander was a Greek.
Alexander was a Macedonian. Greco-Macedonian. The two merged.
Population was
Alexander,
Jewish.
Alexander conquered Egypt roughly 335 BC.
And Alexander was a Greek.
Alexander was a Macedonian. Greco-Macedonian. The two merged. Outside of Greece and Macedon, they would have been thought of as one people, like the northerner and the southerner in this country. Sometime, Egypt became independent of the Ptolemies about 300 BC. And retained that independence until it became a Roman province after Cleopatra.
But these Jews you speak of are merely a portion of the Jewish nation.
Right. Many Jews migrated to Alexandria because under the Ptolemies it became the metropolis of the Mediterranean until Rome eventually surpassed it. And I think for centuries it was the number two city in the Mediterranean world. Oh, yes. Traders. Right. They wouldn't conform. And so they encountered their first pogrom, or mass killing. And they were in trouble with the Egyptians. They were in trouble with the Greco-Macedonians. Philo was an Alexandrian Jew. The original translation of the Old Testament into Greek took place in Alexandria. It was this Jewish colony that sent emissaries to Jesus, asking him to come down there and teach.
In university.
That's right. After the destruction of Jerusalem, the Jews really were dispersed. And they went all over the Roman Empire. They were engaged in various pursuits, farming, trading, mercenary soldiers, this, that, and the other thing. This continued until Christianity got on top in the Roman Empire. And always remember this, it's the Christians who wrote the histories. If others had written the histories, we wouldn't look so good. We favor our side. You'll be amused when you read this book, War Through the Ages. You can tell it's written by a Protestant Christian. Because if you're not a Christian...
We don't look so good after you get up to 300 anyway.
Yeah, if you're not a Christian, you're not a very good militarist. And if you're a Catholic, you're nowhere near as good as you are if you're a Protestant. I mean, the man's bias shows through very clearly. You've got to look very hard before you find the story of the pagan martyrs, the worshippers of Mithras, who are dug up when they dig up the Mithraic temple, and they were slaughtered right in the pews in the act of worshiping. This is how the Christians dealt with their opponents. We know all about the Christian martyrs, but we do not know about the non-Christian martyrs. We speak of Julian the Apostate. Yeah, Julian was one of the most brilliant Romans that ever lived. A scholar who overnight transformed himself into an effective general and was the last Roman to clean up the Rhineland and kick the Krauts so-and-so over Kittel across the Rhine. Well, so much for that. When the Christians got in the saddle, little by little they began passing ordinances against the Jews. The Jewish people had a knack for doing well many things which they did. So they were, by law, prohibited from engaging in agriculture. Then by law, prohibited from engaging in this and that and the other thing, until about all that was left for a Jew to do was to trade and loan money.
Would you say that's why they're not good agriculture?
This is purely a myth. In Palestine, they are excellent farmers.
Right.
Now they are, since yes. they have...
And they react like farmers. They act just like farmers. They're not clever, they're not shrewd. They're the typical country bumpkins. That is, the ones that were born on the farm and grew up on the soil. Jewishness is a culture. It's not a racial thing. It's a cultural thing. The Christian church prohibited loaning money for interest. Now, of course, this is an economic absurdity.
That's something brand new to me.
No.
That's so good.
This was in the later Roman Empire. Any interest you took, any interest, was usury and was sinful. Now, capital now obviously has a value. I'm sure we all would agree. Since you... What?
Well,
you can do pretty well. Well, if you have money and somebody doesn't have money, he's willing to pay you something for the use of your money. I mean, that's conventional today. But in the later Roman Empire and during medieval Christianity, no Christian could accept any interest whatsoever for the utilization of capital. So the Jew became the money lender to the early medieval world. He was forced into a ghetto because he was denied the right to live anywhere except in the ghetto. When the barbarians came in, they lived on easy terms with the Jew, because the Jew knew how to do things that they didn't know how to do.
Where are you now, 1,200?
I'm now about 800. An earlier 600.
Okay.
5, 600. The Jew knew how to get pepper. He had trade contacts. The barbarian liked pepper. The barbarian had no trouble with the Jew until the barbarian began to become commercially sophisticated. Then he took a look at this Jewish enterprise, which was profitable, and he said, I'd like some of that. So there were numerous semi-confiscatory taxations. I mean, just make a 50% capital levy on all the Jewish businessmen in the country. And finally, each nation excluded the Jew from national boundaries. They simply threw them out because they wanted their businesses. And this wasn't a religious thing. During the same
time, they were forced to expand their thinking.
Sure. Right. Wilma, I have a belief if you'd run IQs on a million Jews selected at random and on a million Gentiles selected at random, you'd find the Jews would test out considerably higher because it's been more difficult to survive.
They've
had to. Yeah. Let me pick up another thread now. During this time,
600.
We're up to about 1,200 now in England.
I'm stupid, but I want these dates. I like continuity.
Right. Now I want to go back to around about 650 A.D. We got to pick up the Mohammedan side of the story.
Better believe it, Tony. You're going to be crashing in before too long.
It was then that the Mohammedans burst forth from Arabia. And they weren't quite as hot as you might think, because the Byzantine Romans, the eastern half of the Roman Empire, and the new Persian Empire had just finished a war of utter exhaustion. It was a 30 or 40 years war that had simply stripped them of resources. This was pretty easy picking.
Well, it was a draw too, wasn't it?
What's that?
This war.
Well, yeah, it came out. The way it started. At one time, though, Constantinople had the Persians camped on one side of the straits, and the Avars were camped right up against the walls. There wasn't much left except the city and the provinces of Africa. The Arabs found a nominal Christian provinces that were fed up with all the internal bickerings of Christianity. Unitarianism, Trinitarianism, Monotheism, Nestorianism, high taxation, and whatnot. And I think the Christians proselyted the Mohammedan religion in wholesale lots. The brands of Christianity they were being offered, not too interesting. The Jew fared well under the Mohammedan rule because Muhammad recognized people who had written scriptures and who believed in one God, and they were to be tolerated. They simply paid an extra tax. Otherwise, they were left to do as they pleased. So a Christian or a Jew stood on an equal footing under the Mohammedans. The Jew prospered. The Christian, I think, tended to turn Mohammedan. The Jew clung to his faith. But he was not persecuted. He paid his tax. And he operated. The Jewish community did very well in all Mohammedan lands. They produced mathematicians. They produced chemists. They produced statesmen. They produced writers, geographers, and so on. In Africa, in the Near East, the Jewish inhabitants shared in the Mohammedan decline that started in about the 15th century and has gone on until, well, is Nasser an improvement? I don't know. But at least things are stirring in that area. You're familiar with what happened to the Jew in Spain. When Spain became a consolidated kingdom, the merging of Castile, Leon, Aragon, Navarre, and the final expulsion of the Moors just before the days of Columbus, 1450-60, and through there. Within a generation, the Jewish people were given a choice of conversion to Christianity or pull up and leave.
Yeah.
Get out of Spain. Many converted and remained crypto.
Well, that would have been the Catholicism.
Oh, yeah. That was the only brand of Christianity
that was there
at that time. Many converted and still remained crypto Jewish people. The Iberian nose is a Jewish heritage, which the Spaniard wears proudly to this day. And incidentally, it's not even a Jewish nose, it's a Hittite nose. A typical Semite does not have a hooked nose. Many of the Jews migrated to Italy. Livorno, Leghorn, is a Jewish stronghold. This is the origin of the southern branch of the Jewish people, the Sephardim. The Esterhazyim come from Russia in the east. The Sephardim have had money and education the longest. Barney Baruch is one of the Sephardim Jewish people. The money finder for George Washington was a Jew. I mean, these were the Jews that were here prior to the American Revolution. Let's go back now to Northern Europe. England was the first to kick the Jewish people out. France followed. Germany followed. But before we move them out, let's consider what happened to them during the Crusades. Generally speaking, during the early Middle Ages, the Jew was a victim of Christian superstition. Many stories were circulated concerning the use of slaughtered babies and their blood in Jewish rites. Many mobs arose to kill many Jewish people. The early crusaders who went down the Rhine decided that it would be a pretty good idea to have a little practice on these people.
As they were heading east.
As they were heading east. Now, some of these people had lived there 400 and 500 years.
Warm-up session.
This was a warm-up session.
As they head toward Israel?
They broke into one Jewish synagogue, and they found every member of the congregation there dead, because the men killed the women, and then killed each other, rather than submit to forcible conversion to Christianity. One very sporting Roman German baron, just for kicks, turned a castle over to a local Jewish community. And the Crusaders besieged this castle in vain for 6 months. The Jews held it against all comers. In general, the Christian priest and the Christian person, it was very easy to whip up indignation against the Jewish people, and let's have a little pogrom. In general, the Roman Catholic bishop and the Pope opposed these things. The Catholic bishops and the papacy were enlightened as concerned the Jewish people, gave them sanctuary against Christendom. The higher Catholic clergy comes out pretty clean in the historic annals. The lower clergy and the mass of Christians suffer horribly. I'll say this, if you want to think that the Jew is responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus, he has paid
59.
He has paid a million times in blood. And if you ever want to be ashamed of being a Christian Gentile, read Will Durant's History of the Jews in the Middle Ages. It's a shocking thing to read. It's a shocking thing to read. The Jew kept moving eastward until along about 1500 or 1600, he hit a barrier called the Russian Pale. Russia had been expanding ever since the defeat of the Golden Horde, the Mongols, and the Russians drew a line in mid-Russia, did not exclude the eastern, the western provinces of Russia, but after you went into Russia about 200 miles, there was a line called the Pale, and no Jew was permitted east of this line.
How do you spell it?
P-A-L-E. Beyond the Pale.
Beyond the Pale.
That's the expression.
Okay.
Right. That happens to come from Ireland from a different reason, but it's the same Jew. Some of the Jews in Russia, in fact, many of the Jews in Russia, are not Jews by birth. They're Jews by tradition and culture. One of the last groups of conquerors that came into the Ukraine and South Russia were the Khazars. They were a bunch of hard-riding Asiatic horsemen who came in with the usual technique of murder, fire, rape, and what have you. And they occupied the Ukraine at a time when there was maneuvering between Christian and Mohammedan in this area. And the Khazars wanted to be neutral. They didn't want to go either way. This was the only mass conversion to the Jewish religion that had ever taken place in the history of Jewry. I have talked to some Astrakhan Jews, a few of whom know that they are Khazars. Generally speaking, the Eastern Jew does not know this.
He doesn't.
That's right.
He doesn't know that his forefathers were
just as
in mass.
They're just as non-Jewish as a Swede.
A
blood strain, thankfully. Little by little, as the Europeans developed commercial sophistication, they lost their fear of the Jew. So they relaxed the prohibition and they let him come back westward.
Slowly.
They now had gotten enough commercial savvy so they could compete with the Jew. They let him in with restrictions. They let him live in a ghetto. This is the condition in Jewry until Napoleon. Napoleon abolished the ghetto. Liberty, equality, fraternity extended to the Jewish people as well as all other people. The end of the European ghetto system starts with the Napoleonic era. As I study Jews today, and I study them for the same reason I study Roman Catholics, I have to deal with them, I have to understand them. I have to be able to talk to a Jew within his framework. These people are puzzled. They are terribly sensitive as a people. I know a very few who are not sensitive. This is by actual test measurements. I'm startled when I find a non-sensitive Jew. The thing that he's worried about is the fear that in a moment of anger, his Gentile friend will slap him with a statement, "You Jew." And as...
Like a thing.
Yes. As my Jewish friends have said, to this there is no answer. Now this stands in contrast to an interesting experiment. Israel is, to me, a very interesting test tube. There are a bunch of Jewish youngsters up in Prague behind the Iron Curtain. And it happened to be a little popular in the satellite countries to be anti-Semitic at the moment. So they were sitting in a restaurant, and some of the Czechoslovakians decided they'd bait them, so they called them Jews. These lads kept on eating because, as they had grown up in Israel, there was nothing wrong with being called a Jew. The term had lost its sting to them. Let's consider the quality of Jewishness. A Jewish friend of mine once put it this way. He said, there are three kinds of Jews. There are Hebrews, Jews, and kites. He said, Hebrews wrote the Old Testament. They're among the great people of earth. He said, a man like Baruch is a Hebrew. Einstein was a Hebrew. Brandis is a good example. He said, I'm not that good. He said, I'm a Jew, an ordinary guy. Now he said, I don't like kikes any better than you do. This is poor white trash.
Well,
like Sandy Irish.
Yes, versus lace curtain Irish. The Jew has developed some sociological qualities which have been imposed upon him by the Gentile. He can't join this, that, or the other thing. I recall talking to a Jewish attorney, the only attorney in our company, Standard Oil. And we were at a Flossmoor Golf Club. I was playing with the controller, this attorney, and our director of research. And Roberts, who was a great chemist and very stupid where people were concerned, we had such a good time playing. He said, "Bergie, why don't we get Al in the club out here?" Albert Green was his name. At which point, I almost died because Bergie hit my shin with his foot instead of Robert's shin. And now, I worked with Al Green closely. A finer gentleman I've never known in my life. Al was not a Jew by profession. Al had no religion. His wife was an Episcopalian. His kids were raised Episcopalian. And Joe kept right on talking. And Bergie hit my other shin. And this went on, and I watched poor Al Green turn whiter and whiter and whiter.
And start missing putts?
No, this is the 19th hole.
Oh, you're in the 9th hole.
Until finally, Al turned to Joe Roberts and said, "Joe, you don't understand, I'm a Jew."
Oh.
Then, of course, Roberts damn near died.
You took the brunt of kicks.
I had a couple of sore shins.
Man, I'm physical, too.
And I damn near died, too, because I loved Al.
Yeah.
I worked with Al closely. I knew this man well. Al and I happened to be, well, we used to hold each other's hands because back in the 30s, we were the only two anti-Nazis in that whole company. There are a lot of potential fascists in America. I listened to them in the 30s.
There are in the 60s.
Yeah, I know.
Bill, too, so many of the 70s. If they find that them being Jewish doesn't matter to you, they don't very good.
Sure, that's right. Let's consider what I want to call ghetto traits. Ghetto traits are produced by ghettos. They are sociological. They are not genetic or biological. Toynbee makes a good point when he says that the Jew who is born on the land in Palestine and grows up a farmer, whose father farmed, whose grandfather founded that farm, this is about as far back as you can go, he reacts just like a farmer. He's guileless. You can sell him the Brooklyn Bridge. He'll buy gold bricks just like farmers do. He doesn't know any better. Toynbee also makes this point. Can you consider anybody brawnier, nervier, tougher than the Normans? The Vikings who settled in the north of France, who conquered England, who conquered the south of Italy and Sicily. Frederick Hohenstaufen was a Norman. The spearhead of the Crusades were Normans. Richard Coeur de Lion was a Norman. Yes, yes. They're the Northmen. A Norman is a corruption of Northmen. The French couldn't keep them off the coast, so they got smart. They gave them the coast and says, "Here, settle down and keep your friends out, see." This is the origin of the Duchy of Normandy. About 100 years before the days of William the Conqueror. These Norman descendants of the Crusaders were caught by the Ottoman Turks when the Ottoman Turks overran this area. When the Turks took over, they organized the cities and they put all of the Christians in ghettos, exactly like a Jewish ghetto. And in these ghettos, the descendants of these Norman knights developed the same traits that a Jew develops in a ghetto, which is becoming servile, slippery, double-dealing, anything to survive. So much so that the Turks in their heyday, they were tough fighters. They had two expressions for a Christian. a Sweetwater Frank who lived in the ghetto and they would spit on him, and a Saltwater Frank who came from across the water and was a tough fighter like they were. They had contempt for a Sweetwater Frank. They respected a Saltwater Frank. There's the story of the
ghetto, too, takes away they don't have the outside influence to make them fighters and all.
That's right. Don't. How can you stand up and get tough and you get killed quick. So pretty soon you learn you don't stand up and get tough. You're a hopelessly outnumbered.
Well, Bill, according to your way of thinking, the Jewish people were not the chosen race.
I think they were, yes. I think they missed their boat.
Yes, do you think they were chosen, or do you think they were designated?
I think they were. I think they had an opportunity which they missed. As the papers point out, they could have become a royal priesthood. Palestine prepared them for life anywhere on the face of the earth. They proved it. They thrived everywhere they've gone, from China to America.
America, yeah.
The Jewish people were unique in one respect only. They had a succession of prophets. No other people in recorded history had the succession of teachers the Jews had. They had individuals, yeah. One or two, but not a dozen. From Samuel to Deuteronomy, they came with regularity. And as you study the Old Testament in chronological order, you can see the papers make this point very clearly. Yahweh evolved. Yahweh started out as a fairly 2x4, a kind of a 2-bit cheap god of a fulminating volcano who was strictly tribal, who was a conniver, who said to the Jews, glom onto everything you can lay your hands on before you leave Egypt. This is a god who doesn't care about the Egyptian, you know. Steal from the strangers. Then you wind up with Deutero-Isaiah. Well, Jesus practically exhausted the Old Testament in quoting him. Jesus was willing to adopt this concept as representative of his father. There's only one other religion, I think, that's had a parallel evolution. That's Northern Buddhism. Northern Buddhism has evolved a tremendous god concept, I think. Toynbee points out that, well, Toynbee draws a conclusion that the two best religions on the face of the earth are Christianity and Mahayana Buddhism. And then he draws a further conclusion. Neither of them is adequate. Neither is that. And I agree with them. They're the two best. If I'd never heard about Christianity, I would be a Mahayana Buddhist. Yes.
Bill, what is the situation of the Jew, the Eastern Jew, at the height of the Crusades?
It depends on how long he's been there. When he first goes, he's welcome because he brings many nice things. They like him. He has pepper. He has foreign exchange. He has exotic foods. Silks. He never lost his international contacts. And then little by little, you figure out, he's making money off this. He's making money off me. Let's take it away from him. We outnumber him.
Well, is he there's so astute that he is trading with both Muhammad?
Oh, yeah. Sure. He was a Brit.
Muhammadan and the Christian. And getting fairly well adjusted to where he can deal with both of them.
He got his markup. The thing that is not liked about a Jew how many drivers who have a driver cut them off in front sharply, they'll cuss if it's a man, but if it's a woman, they'll say, ah, another woman driver. If it's a man driver, they just say, you know, they don't comment on the sex of the driver.
Oh, home.
Oh, this is true.
That's all right.
If you are outsmarted by a Gentile, you are outsmarted. But if you're outsmarted by a Jew, you remember that it was a Jew who outsmarted
you.
I went down to Philadelphia, and I spent a week with a group of the toughest merchants on the East Coast. It's the worst merchandising corner in North America. It's where Gimbel's, Strawbridge and Clothier, and Litt Brothers operate. On the fourth corner, they should have an ulcerate heart clinic. There is no other corner like it in the world that I know of. Wanamaker's is down the road just a little from there. Litt Brothers is the toughest, lowest grade store in Philadelphia. I mean, this is price. This is dog eat dog, tooth and fang. This is a Jewish operation. When I got back to Chicago, some of my buddies says, well, how did you make out down there? I said, what do you mean? Well, I mean, you're kind of with the tribe. I said, oh, I see what you mean. I said, they're interesting people. I said, I found them very stimulating because I can think just as fast as the smartest of them. But I said, God help me, if I hadn't been able to think that fast, I would have come away with great resentment.
Is Wanamaker's trying to buy that fourth corner? Do they want to really?
No, I don't think so. No, they're well rooted down in the story.
Bill, on the chosen people deal, would you elaborate on that just a little bit? Were they a chosen people? I'm wondering if we're using the wrong word.
Abraham was a chosen person.
You don't think they were loved? Do you think they were loved any more than anyone
else? But I think they were prepared to do a job.
Well, then would the word designate be applicable at all?
I think so. I think the Jewish people had a possibility. Stop and consider, why did Jesus appear on earth as a Jew?
I think they were better prepared as a religious.
Right.
They believed in one God.
That's right. Can you think of any other reason?
They were located geographically.
Yeah. They were also a blend of good stock. Able stock. They had a compulsory educational system.
I tell you, Bert, what? I'll accept your designation. You accept my chosen, and let's stop that.
They also had profited from Machiavelli in Salem, which is Jerusalem. I mean, that was the seat of what they call it, the University of Salem, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't an accident.
I didn't ever think it was natural.
This was a crossroads of the world.
I get a healthy respect for Moses.
This was a crossroads of the world.
He was a brilliant.
Moses is my
a
ideal.
A brilliant man.
Moses is my ideal.
Moses was a brilliant man.
Think that he
did a little conniving, but...
he was actually given the Ten Commandments on the stone. You think he could go down himself?
You can go get a drink of water.
Did I interrupt you?
I don't
know.
Wilma, I don't know.
You never cease to make.
Wilma, I don't know, except I will say this. I think Moses is willing. I think Moses had the same philosophy that St. Paul had. I'm willing to do and be whatever is necessary to get my story across. Paul said, I'm willing to be all things to all men. I think Moses shared that. Now, whether you agree with these men or disagree
somehow
with them, they were successful.
Paul a little more. I think Paul was more desperate.
Paul had more to work with. Moses had nothing.
I think I respect Moses more because he had less ammunition.
Good heavens. Paul was working with a literate society. Moses was working with illiterate people.
Bedouins.
People that had nothing but gross Bill? Superstition.
Oh, Bill.
And a bunch of rags on their back.
You can handle illiterate people better than you can literate.
But it takes different tactics.
Sure.
And Moses used
the
tactics that were necessary.
And Paul used the tactics.
Apparently so. These men succeeded. Abner failed.
Say, I want to elaborate on that. In what way did Abner fail? I didn't know that he did.
All right, let's pick up some more history.
He
was here.
the thing that transmitted Jesus' message to the world was the Greek language and Greek culture. It very quickly passed from the Jewish to the Greek. Rome studied Greek civilization. The Roman recognized that whatever the Greek, the limitations of the Greek, Greek culture was a higher level of culture than Roman culture. In 500 BC, Athens was a dictator, and Rome was a little fording place on the Tiber River, having just recently expelled the Etruscans. The Etruscans were far in advance of the Romans, or the Latins. When Alexander conquered the East, there was a mass exodus from Greece and Macedonia that most historians overlook. Think of how many Alexandrias were founded, Antiochs were founded, and so on, Alexandretas. This was the original Drang nach Osten, the march on the east. There must have been a mass exodus out of Greece and Macedonia to the east, because these people had to come from somewhere. There's a reason why the Romans found the Greeks such easy picking 200 years later. I think Greece was pretty well denuded of people, and especially of its more adventurous, able people. This produced not a solid culture, but a steel structure, a spiderweb steel structure of Greek culture, which went from city to city, effectively all the way from the Aegean Sea to the Indus River. The cultural transmission lines were in existence to transmit Jesus' message east just as effectively as west. It wasn't as extensive numerically, but it was just as extensive in terms of the permeation of cultural centers. The city dwellers spoke Greek, all the way to the Indus River, at least as a second language, and many Greeks lived there. Even after the Parthians cut this empire in two, the eastern wing under the Bactrians continued to be Greek, and they conquered extensively in North India. They spread a thin veneer of Greek culture all over North India. When they lost their original homelands in Parthia, they persisted. When they lost Afghanistan, they persisted in what's now Pakistan and the Kashmir. They lasted until about the times of Jesus' boyhood. Then they were conquered in turn by some nomads who came in, much as the Ostrogoths came into Italy. They came in friendly-like. They didn't want to tear down civilization, they wanted to preserve it. These nomads were pro-Greek. They were the Kushans. And at that time, it produced a peculiar-shaped state built like a boomerang. Can you see Pakistan on the map? And Afghanistan? Here you've got India coming down like this, see? Then you've got the Indus River coming up here, and you've got Afghanistan up here. All right. This whole area was the southern end of the Kushan kingdom. Then it went up into what's now Russian Turkestan. And then it turned and went east, north of Tibet, into what's Chinese Turkestan. It was boomerang shaped. In about 90 AD, and this I think is one of the really crucial events of history, a religious fermentation took place in the Kushan domains. And what is virtually a new religion evolved. This is the origin of Mahayana Buddhism. Hinayana Buddhism, the Buddhism that continued in India till it was wiped out, and which still continues in Burma and Ceylon, is Hinayana Buddhism. Call it fundamentalist Buddhism if you want to. The original teachings of Buddha. Mahayana Buddhism are based more on the life of Buddha. And the one is greater than the other, as Jesus aptly pointed out when talking to Conant. Your Buddha was much greater than your Buddhism. Buddha's life has more truth in it than Buddha's teachings. Buddha taught a teaching which would cause a man to become a monk, to withdraw from the world, to seek his salvation in isolation. This is the concept of the Arhat, or the saint of Hinayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism teaches a counter concept, the concept of the Bodhisattva, or the one who spends himself in the service of the world. The Arhat is based on what Buddha said. The Bodhisattva is based on how Buddha lived. This new religion was born in the Kushan domains under the friendly rule of these conquering nomads who weren't Buddhists, who weren't Christians, who weren't Hindus, but were mildly pro-Greek in their attitudes. And because of this political government, which was kind of neutral and uncontending in the religious sense, it favored the evolution of this religion. This is the religion that moved up over the high passes in Central Asia and around the seaports and came to China and to Japan. This is the religion which overspread Confucian morality just as the teachings of Jesus overspread Socratic philosophy in Europe. Confucian morality is not a religion, really. It's a code of ethics. And it didn't fight with Buddhism any more than Greek philosophy fought with Christianity. They reconciled to each other. This is where the teachings of Jesus should have latched on to Buddhism as a carrier in the East, just as they latched on to Judaism as a carrier in the West. Buddhism would have served as the ideal vehicle for carrying the teachings of Jesus to the whole Orient. And there's no reason why you shouldn't float Jesus on top of Buddha just as much as you float Jesus on top of Moses and Isaiah. He floats anywhere you put him. The good Lord provided the channel, but the good Lord has also endowed human beings with freedom of choice. And he can't override those choices. Now, Abner should have prepared the way. But Abner made the same mistake that the Melchizedek missionaries made in Mesopotamia. Melchizedek commissioned his teachers to preach that God is trustworthy, that God is a covenant-keeping deity. And instead they got all mixed up with social reform. They decided that temple prostitution was a reprehensible practice, and so they went out on a big mass crusade to clean up the temples, and as a result, the whole Melchizedek teaching got plowed under. Now maybe temple prostitution is reprehensible, but Melchizedek had not told them to go out in the world and clean up prostitution. He said, teach about God. Jesus never commissioned Abner to